This is Solo Travel Talk. Your solo travel advisor is Astrid Clements.
Icon is a word that might be thrown around a little bit, might get overused, but then one comes upon an artist whose influence ripples throughout culture. The Frida Kahlo Museum, commonly known as Casa Azul, is home to a phenomenal collection and is the former home of artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. I'm producer Catherine O'Brien. Your solo travel advisor, Astrid Clements, had the pleasure of visiting Casa Azul and thinks it's a must for a solo traveler visiting Mexico City. Astrid, what should listeners know about Frida Kahlo so they can fully appreciate this museum?
Well, Catherine, I really do hope I can do this the subject of Frida Kahlo justice. She was such a powerful, conflicted, and beautiful Mexican woman whose fame today has definitely reached iconic status. I mean, Frida Kahlo, and I didn't actually realize to the extent that she is revered till I went to the Frida Kahlo Museum. Somewhat like Princess Diana, Marilyn Monroe, Evita Perón, and maybe even Cleopatra, she had so many heartaches and misfortunes in her life, but these factors are what propelled her to this legendary status. I mean, when I go into her life, for those of you that don't know anything about it, it's going to pique your interest. But before I share a brief synopsis of her life, here are some of the words and phrases that have been used to describe her. Mestizo, dignified, powerful, rebellious, broken, saint, feminist, intellectual, bisexual, unique, fashionista, childless, fragile, communist, fun-loving, handicapped, contradictory, gorgeous, monobrow, colorful, victim, vulnerable, alcoholic, cross-dresser, lover, bohemian, survivor. Madonna had mentioned her before and called her the real drama queen, and that was one of the reasons why she kind of identified with her. But I would probably say, in the most kind of au courant way, she was the real badass woman. I know my daughter, a couple of years ago, somebody said, "Oh, badass." I said, "That's horrible to call a woman badass." And my daughter said, "Oh, no, that is the huge compliment." So, some of the quotes about her is, she created herself as a subject who was female, Mexican, modern, and powerful. She was a survivor who fought back. She felt murdered by life. Frida Kahlo was something else, some rare bird that was and is today fascinating. Okay, so those are just words and a few little phrases about her, but you know, as I go through this show, you'll get more and more of the picture about, oh my gosh, this woman was just so incredible that she really moved me. I must say, that's one of the reasons why I'm doing this particular podcast, because I feel like she's a tremendous inspiration for women especially, but anybody. Okay, a little bit about her roller coaster life, and it was a roller coaster. First of all, she was born into a mixed-race, middle-class family. Her father was European. He was German and a photographer. Her mother was Spanish with Indian or Oaxacan blood, and she was considered what they call a mestizo, a combination of European and ethnic Indian or Mexican Indian blood. She was born in Coyoacan, which is a suburb of Mexico City, and basically Mexico City now, in Casa Azul. She lived here in this home that she was born in most of her entire life, and she died there. So that in itself, this woman is an icon who was born in the same house, lived there most of her whole life, and died there, and was severely handicapped. And she's this famous, this powerful for all the right reasons. She developed polio at the age of 6. She had to stay in bed 9 months when she was a 6-year-old child. Now, you know that affected her psychologically. Well, from the polio, she had a withered leg, right leg, her whole life, and she had a small limp after that. And all of her, you know, a lot of her friends teased her and called her peg leg. Well, she was athletic too. On top of that, she was athletic. 13 years old, she had a female gym teacher molest her, if you can believe that. So sad. As a young teenager and a teenager and a young adult, she was beautiful, precocious, smart. Her father, after this happened to her, with the female gym teacher, sent her to a very prestigious private school. She ended up joining this group of 9, and they thought themselves to be young intellectuals and free thinkers. And at that time, she wanted to become a doctor. I guess from the polio and all that, she just decided, well, I'm going to be a doctor, and maybe, you know, I can help people not get sick or whatever. Well, it was either age 18 or 19. She was involved in a horrific, life-threatening bus trolley accident. I mean, her pelvis was crushed. She had some kind of rail that went completely through her body and out of her body. Her legs were mangled. I mean, she was so beat up that they were surprised that she lived. From this terrible accident, throughout her life, she sustained over 32 operations, which left her in constant increasing pain. So she had a lifetime of being bedridden, then wheelchairs, crutches, corsets, prosthetic shoes, and even later a limb, because they ended up having to cut the right leg off at the knee. I mean, let me tell you, she had a lot of struggle and pain that most 99.9% of the people will never have to face. So after this accident, she decided that she couldn't be a doctor and that she would focus on being an artist. And at that time, she ends up meeting Diego Rivera, which she does marry. And he was and is one of the most famous Mexican artists. He's most famous for being Mexico's premier muralist. And at that time, murals were very popular. He was also a communist, and her parents really weren't for this marriage, even though he had status and he had money. I don't know if he was really wealthy, but he was in the upper crust. But they would describe those two as the elephant and the dove, because he was a big man, like 6'3", something like that, 300 pounds, and she was very petite, and, you know, her body, as I've already shared with you, was very compromised. But they fell in love. I mean, she was some kind of woman, crippled and all. She had it. Well, he was also a womanizer, which gave her intense pleasure, but it gave her a lot of pain. He even had an affair with her sister, which caused her to divorce him, but they ended up getting married again within a year. Basically, she adored him, and he was her obsession. She had abortions and miscarriages, and really mostly because her body was so crushed from this horrific accident. Their marriage really was very free-thinking, and it was an open marriage, which for that day and time in the early 1900s, whew, that was, especially in a Spanish-Mexican, old world society, and he was part of that society. That was pretty out there. Well, it wasn't just open on his side. It was open on her side, too. I mean, she had an affair with Leon Trotsky, the famous Russian communist who fled to Mexico City, of which Frida and Diego housed in Casa Azul when they first got there. She had several lesbian trysts. And she had an affair with a lot of the artists that, like Anton, I think Breton, André Breton, who was a French collector and who really loved her work. I think she had an affair with him. And she didn't let the night go by alone. If Diego wasn't around, even though she adored Diego. I mean, you know, she would have probably never done that unless he would have behaved himself. But he was, So that was very painful to her, but she coped with it the best that she could. She began her artist career convalescing in the bed after this horrific accident. And she said painting was her therapy at that time. And what her father did, she wasn't married yet. He put a wood canopy over her Tista bed, and he had a mirror installed, and he had an easel made so she could lie in bed with the easel and have the mirror above so she could do self-portraits, and she could paint all kinds of things. I mean, her father was adoring to her. So he made it to where she could be in the bed and start painting, or basically start her therapy, her self-therapy. And she was known for her native Mexican folk art style, which was very colorful, somewhat primitive, lots of symbols, highly symbolic. She got a lot of her inspiration from Mexican culture, and she tended to, which is typical in the culture of the Mesoamerican area of Mexico, but they combined elements of pre-Columbian or pagan beliefs and traditional Catholic beliefs in her artistic work. She explored the question of identity and existence in her paintings. So her paintings are not just paintings. They all are saying something that is coming out of her that she needs to express, that has something to do with what's it all about, not Alfie, Diego. But it's, you know, she's always struggling with this. But in this, there's so much life and so much realness and so much authenticity that people love her art and love what was coming out of her. Because with all this fire, she was very sweet, kind of, I wouldn't call her sweet, but she was very, if she was so real that people, when you're drawn to something and you don't know why, but you are, and that you know then it's really good. Well, she was that kind of artist. surrealist quality. She mixed realism and fantasy. She did a lot of self-portraits and portraits, and also what's called retablos. And I'll go into a little bit more of the retablos when I go through her home, because I know you'll want to know something about Casa Azul itself. And then in her later years, she actually started doing still lifes, fruits, flowers, political symbols, flags, doves. She got into all of that Mexican Revolution and glorifying the working man, and also trying to lift up the opportunities of the underprivileged Mexicans, etc., the indigenous Mexican cultures. She was very much for that. She felt like that is where the heart and soul of Mexico is, mm-hmm. not by Spanish domination. So she got into the political aspect, and you'll see it in her paintings. She probably did somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 paintings. They haven't all been, I think, categorized or found yet. But she was, like I said, heavily influenced by what you call, or the word is, Mexicanidad, the romantic nationalism that developed after the Mexican Revolution. And she was big, like I said, on resisting the mindset of the cultural inferiority that was created by colonialism. And really, before the Mexican Revolution, folk culture was really frowned upon by the elites. They just thought that wasn't art at all, and it wasn't looked up to at all. Well, her and Diego, they completely changed that whole viewpoint. Then in the 1920s, Mexican art scene started being dominated by muralists. And Diego Rivera really was the number one. And he was fabulous at it. I mean, he was like the fresco painters of Italy, Michelangelo and everything. But all of his subject matter or the themes were socialist realism, and like I said, glorifying the different ethnic groups of Mexico, the Mexican common worker, the common man, and how that's the colorful tapestry of what real Mexico is all about. So he painted these things, and it was very popular. And they would put them in, you know, the Bellas Artes museum and theater. And so it was such a great painter that it really did even help make murals more popular at that time. And he had a tremendous influence on Frida's political beliefs and what she painted. It, going to, like I said, these retablos, they weren't totally political, but the retablos were something that, well, they were painted on tin, and a lot of people, common people, would paint them who had artistic talent. And they were a combination of like pagan and Catholicism beliefs, where somebody would have a problem or an affliction, and they would have the affliction, say the prayer, and then if it was cured or they were healed, they would paint this scene on these small things of tin, write the prayer, and thank Jesus or thank whoever they wanted to thank for saving them, whether it was a saint, etc. But this was a wonderful practice by the common artists of Mexico, and not here again revered by the elite. Well, she began to paint retablos too, and she had a collection of over 2,000. So you know she prayed a lot. But in a lot of hers, she didn't put the prayer at the bottom. She just put the scene. You know, so it was, she had those beliefs, but she was also a communist. I mean, she wasn't totally sure about the spiritual realm in terms of traditional rhythm, religion. But I don't think she wanted to completely let it go, because that was part of who she was too. Because her mother was very religious. Now, she didn't get along with her mother very well. Supposedly her mother was kind of cold to her, even though she dressed her up and she was always cute and fancy when she was young. She was very close to her dad. In her painting, she also used a lot of Aztec symbols. Monkeys, skeletons, skulls, blood hearts. I mean, things that, you know, you want to look at skeletons. Well, she had a way of putting them in there that kind of was like, you know, It that wasn't off-putting. She's most known for her self-portraits, of which she painted 66 self-portraits. Now, most people would say, my God, why was she painting herself? You know, well, let me tell you, she had a lot of what she wanted to say by painting herself. Some of her most famous self-portraits are The Broken Column, Sleeping with a Skeleton, Two Fridas, Frida and Diego on their wedding day, her family, her own birth, and her miscarriages. She did a lot of strange, kind of surrealist things with body parts and stuff. It's really kind of out there. But I read something one time, or in doing some of the research, that said, you know, she wanted to become a doctor. And this was maybe her way of still being connected into those natural tendencies of a doctor. You know, this is all part of how her mind was processing what she had to struggle with. But it was it's very surreal. But it's pretty, like, you don't forget it when you see it. And then Frida with Diego in her forehead, like a third eye. Oh, she did a few of those. So in these paintings, these self-portraits, she's powerful. She's in horrific physical and psychological pain, but still highly impressive and beautiful. Now, that's hard to do. I mean, you have to truly be a real great artist, no matter if your style is primitive or realistic or whatever, to be able to carry that off. Some of the more quotes about her is, she paints because she needs to. She paints what's on her mind. She confronts and communicates her pain to overcome it. Her own quote is, I never painted dreams. I painted my own reality. So this is what was in her head. She was the first Mexican to have a painting in the Louvre. A female, a mestizo, having the first Mexican painting in the Louvre. Now, that is something else. Who was handicapped and hardly ever left Casa Azul. The Tate Modern Museum considered her to be one of the most significant artists in the 20th century, not just Latin America. In 1944, Sotheby's sold her first painting, called The Tree of Hope, for $19,000. Then in 1990, they again auctioned off the painting Diego and I for $1 million. And it was the first Latin American painting and artist that's work sold over $1 million. In 2006, the painting Roots garnered $5.6 million. In 2016, The Two Lovers in the Forest, $8 million. So you can see that Frida Kahlo was and is a significant artist and the value of her works are just going up and up. Okay. No background information would be complete about Frida Kahlo without sharing her personal fashion style. Frida was one hell of a fashionista. I mean, she loved to dress, she loved clothes, and she loved jewelry. Another quote I read is, when she entered a room, all eyes were on her. Now, can you imagine this? A woman with a limp who had to wear corsets and all kinds of stuff, that she was like, she was the woman in the room. I just think that the reason why it just makes me so, I guess, fired up is because it all came from within. She didn't have to make anything up. It just flowed out of her. And she was not like everybody else. I mean, she was completely different. I mean, you know, people talked about her, but then also you knew they go, ooh, ooh. The men, I'm sure, all would go, ooh, ooh, ooh. She wore traditional Mexican peasant clothing as a statement of pride of her mestizo ancestry, which was very unusual because, you know, the crowds that she was in, they were bohemian, but they were upper class. So, you know, her coming with the long, colorful skirts with cotton or silk and then the lace at the bottom, I mean, they would think, well, you know, who's that to help or something? But not the way she wore it. And lace and hand-embroidered, beautiful handmade blouses, Guatemalan coats. She loved these cotton tunics called, I think it's upils, you say it, or it's H-U-I-P-I-L-S, but they're like long tunics that go to right above the knee, and it has kind of a belt in the back, or you can belt them with a separate belt, but they're usually embroidered, and underneath that she'd wear like a white lace skirt or, you know, something. And then, you know, she would wear a headdress or whatever. I mean, the way she dressed was something else. She loved what's called rebozos, which are those beautiful shawls that have their long fringes. And this was a Oaxacan symbol of femininity. And you'll see her in paintings with that. You'll see her in photographs with these rebozos. She loved them. Embroidered belts. In Mexico, especially in this area of Mexico, they have these beautiful belts that they embroider, and that goes over the long skirt and maybe the more simple top, and then, you know, and she always had, I mean, she was dressed to perfection all the time. Lots of jewelry, and I mean jewelry that made noise. Chandelier earrings, bracelets, rings on every finger. And she liked jadeite and onyx necklaces. So she was into jewelry. Headdresses, oh my gosh. There's a tribe or whatever called Tijuanan, and that she loved this hairstyle. They have like massive woolen braids, and then she'd put marigolds in her hair, whether they were silk or real, butterflies, I mean, you know, skeletons. I mean, her headdresses were something else, as well as she would adorn her corsets. I mean, she painted her corsets. One of them had a hammer and a sickle, but some of them were beautiful leather. And I mean, I'm telling you, her clothes and the way she dressed was very important. And basically I say here, her clothing was carefully chosen to share the Mexico she knew and loved, which is beautiful. And I guess you would really categorize her style as she was original boho or sophisticated bohemian. I mean, all of this that you see now, this ethnic wear and everything, she was the first person that really actually did it. And now it's cool. I mean, it really, you see it in so many forms and expressions now. But Frida really, she probably was totally the muse of that. I can't specifically say that, but she was right there at the beginning. And her style was to create her own identity and to hide her disabilities. She really didn't want anybody to know that she was in pain or, you know, her body was just, I mean, and what's so sad is you see photographs of her, you know she had a beautiful body, but she had to strap it in with all these corsets and then her legs all messed up and she has this gorgeous face. I mean, but, you know, she just decided, well, you know, I'm going to live to the fullest. Also, Diego loved to see her in these clothes. And she is very Oaxacan looking with a strong Spanish kind of German look to her too. So they look very good on her and her coloring. In 1937, she was featured in Vogue. Now, you know, here's this woman from Mexico in 1937 being featured in Vogue, who's has disabilities. I mean, that's pretty strong. Also, a famous French designer, Elsa Schiaparelli, I think that's how you say her name, created a dress inspired by Frida called Robe Madame Rivera. And Elsa Schiaparelli was kind of like, I think, Coco Chanel and her kind of vied for who was the coolest at that time. So, you know, that was pretty amazing. Then Jean-Paul Gaultier and De Reese more recently, some of these corset dresses that you see in these dresses that have structure on the outside or whatever, that was inspired by Frida. I mean, that's amazing that this woman, that the fashion muses tapped into that. You know, she could make a corset sexy. That is pretty good. And actually, this week, there's going to be an exhibition starting at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London called Frida Kahlo Making Herself Up. And this is the first time her clothing will be touring outside of Mexico. What happened, I think it was in 2004, a trunk was opened in her house. And there, this trunk was closed for 50 years after her death. And by Diego didn't want to, any of it to be disturbed, and neither did the executor of her estate. But they finally opened it up, and that's where they found the treasure trove of her clothes, her jewelry, her makeup, her diary, her personal letters. Wow. So, you know, this is why now you can see and understand her a lot more. But, you know, bottom line, it's pretty amazing that her legacy is still, her fashion legacy is still going strong. I mean, to me, it just amazes me. She's really more famous in death than in life. And there's a word now for people who love Frida, is Fridamania. I mean, really, she's like I said, like Marilyn Monroe, faces on handbags, t-shirts, posters. They made a movie about her. She's basically a cult figure in pop culture. People are wearing shawls, ethnic clothes, layers of jewelry, everything that she did. You know, that's something else. I think it's hard to understand, how powerful that soul and that, who she was. But it pushed on. Like I said, just like Marilyn Monroe, Princess Diana, Cleopatra, they were all fabulous women, but they had so many problems and so many, you know, but their their essence. It was just so, people can't get enough of them. Many women identify with her because she was someone who overcomes her heartaches and her pain by her own will, courage, and inner strength. Frida was and is the bomb. Badass woman, I don't like that word, but the bomb, that was Frida.
Well, I think that gives everybody a really good knowledge about a base to work with who Frida Kahlo is. But let's turn to the Casa Azul. You told us that it was her birthplace, but now today, describe what Casa Azul has become. The collection sounds just amazing. It's not just her artwork. It's an entire collection.
Oh yeah. Basically, Casa Azul was Frida's oasis. I mean, as I shared several times, she was born there, she lived there most of her life, and she died there. And it's a large hacienda, basically, painted electric blue, like Yves Saint Laurent blue, with these beautiful, or it's trimmed, the windows are trimmed in kind of a henna red, and they have a kind of olive green iron grills over them, and it's all wrapped around a lush, beautiful courtyard and gardens. And, the minute that you enter Casa Azul, you feel a vibe. I mean, there's magic in this space all over, whether it's in the courtyard or in Diego's bedroom or in the kitchen. I mean, every space. I mean, it is just, this is like hallowed ground, and you can feel it. I mean, it's amazing. This hacienda was her home, but the interiors she created are a museum of her and her fascinating life. So when you go there, it's so interesting that it blew me away, to tell you the truth. When I visited Casa Azul, there was a school field trip of young kids right in front of me. So when we went in, they went the regular way to the left. I went right. So I wanted to do the tour backwards to avoid them. So the first room that I entered was the exhibit of her crutches, her corsets, and her painkillers. And I have to say, I was completely floored. I never knew she was handicapped. I just thought she was a famous, beautiful Mexican artist that I saw on T-shirts and bags, and I was kind of curious about, this Frida Kahlo. And I have a friend here in Louisiana, and she's a Frida Kahlo. Frida mania. So, but I definitely wanted to go to Casa Azul just as one of the museums. But when I went into this room, I was in such shock. I couldn't believe that she was handicapped. Then next you see her fabulous clothes, her unbelievable shoe collection. One of the shoes is this red silk shoe that was built up, hand-embroidered flowers on the top with silk laces that basically was on her prosthetic leg. I mean, it was really shocking and moving. You see her jewelry, her perfume, her beauty products. I mean, you get a commentary on, this type of blouse and this Guatemalan jacket, and you see how she put it all together. I mean, you get it right there. Boy, she was beautifully dressed. And then the next room basically is Diego's bedroom. And this one was somewhat sparse. It was the most sparse of all of the rooms in the house. It had what I call the Mexican silent butler, which these are these little stands. They're like hat racks that are a little above the waist. Whenever you go to a really nice restaurant or anywhere that is very, you know, upper crust, I guess you would say, they put a little silent butler so you can put your jacket or you could put your purse or whatever. It's such a nice touch. I love it. But she had his, silent butler in there, a photograph of him over his double bed, a few pieces of ethnic pottery in an antique painting, and then his hats and overalls were hung up on a little rack on one of the long walls. And it was so poignant. I mean, it was like, you know, you could just see him. And he was a really big man in these big, but I know that when he wasn't there, those overalls and those hats, I mean, she had something there in there that, you know, I mean, when I tell you she was obsessed with him, she was obsessed. Ugh, it makes me so sad. You know, because I know, I mean, granted he was a womanizer, but probably it's just being a real man. You know, she was so fragile in her body. And then, you know, she got very hooked on the painkillers and all her problems. She even was also drank a fifth of gin a day or something at one point. I mean, you know, he probably had to have some normalcy or something, you know, so it just was all part of how it was complicated, you know, but he loved her. Now that, I mean, and he, after she died, I mean, he was really like, he was much more upset about the whole thing than he ever imagined that he could be. I thought the bedroom, his bedroom, it was very emotive, even though it was the most sparse out of any of the rooms. Then you come to her bedroom. Now, her bedroom was small, but it was very, whew. She had her small, wood, beautiful bed, carved bed. Now, above it had the mirror, which was just like a half mirror. And then she also had some ceramic looking kind of figures that I considered to be Mexican ethnic talisman or something. And she had a blue gazing ball over that. So I'm sure in some of her beliefs or her early experiences with, you know, pagan Mexican spiritual things, that those were, she needed those by her bed. On the wall, behind her bed, was a kind of a artistic skeleton, which here again, you know, skeletons and death and everything in Mexican culture has a lot more loving meaning in terms of ancestor worship and life. It's not some evil demented thing, you know. So she had that. Then her bed had a beautiful bedspread with hand embroidered flowers on it. But on the bed was her death mask, which was black ceramic, her beautiful face, and then it was surrounded by this ethnic shawl that was done kind of in like a sunburst. It was blue and kind of off white, but it was all handmade. I mean, you wanted to just take a knee, you know, just to pray for a minute. I mean, you could feel her in that room. I mean, it was pretty special, and not in a spooky way. She also had a photo collage of the famous communists, Lenin, Stalin, Trotsky, that was at the foot of her bed on the wall. And I'm pretty sure there was the roll top desk, and on top of it was a bookcase. That might have been in another room, because there were Then there were two rooms on both sides of her bedroom. One was in between Diego's bedroom and her bedroom, and then one was between her where she painted and her artist studio and her bedroom. But in these two rooms, she had a lot of Mexican folk art. She loved Mexican folk art, and they collected it, and it is all over this house. So in itself, it's a museum of Mexican folk art. She also had a lot of miniatures, and she made these miniatures also. You know, some of them kind of like toy houses, but, you know, I got the feeling, like I said, she was childless. And I got the feeling that, you know, when this happened, this polio happened to her, that's where she first kind of had an arrested emotional development. So she was always a little bit like childlike, or there was something, and sweet is not exactly that, but there was something like a young, a little girl. And, you know, so I don't know if these miniatures and this toy houses and things like that, it gave her some solace that she never had any kids and she still had those feelings. I don't really know, but you see that in there. Then there was another thing in this room between Diego's bedroom and her bedroom. There's a big urn, a big frog urn, and they used to call, well, she would call him Frog, or the Frog. Well, that's where her ashes are in there. So it's kind of, that's kind of, and then here again, going to, like I said, I there was something about her that just kind of made me think that she was like a child in some kind of way, you know, just a precocious child. There was a little bench that had rattan, a seat, wooden bench carved. So, you know, the back had flowers, and then it was in the middle, it had Frida, 1910. So, you know, her parents had this little bench made for her so she could sit and, you know, feel special, even though she had polio. So, I mean, that, you don't want to cry, but you kind of think, oh, golly. You know what I'm saying? You can feel that.
There's something touching about it.
Yes, it's very touching. The house is very, Casa Azul touches your heart. Okay. Then in the next room between her studio and her bedroom, I've got all the fabulous paintings of hers and Diego's. You'll see her, she has a family portrait in there. She has the cesarean and Frida when she had tried to have a cesarean or wanted to have one and it wasn't successful. Frida and Stalin. Then she has this beautiful, oh God, I would have loved to have this painting, circular still life. And it's kind of painted in a traditional format, darker colors that are typical of Spanish style of oil paintings, but they're still colorful. This is a beautiful painting. And then her last painting, which is a still life of all watermelons, called Viva la Vida, which is basically long live life. And that was one of her things, is like, you know, just do it, just live, you know, get on with it. Then you have quite a few of Diego's cubist paintings. And then from, well, actually, let me see. I might be kind of mixed up in how the rooms are all organized. But you come to the kitchen, or the dining room, and then the kitchen area. They're filled again with all kinds of Mexican folk art and painting. The dining room is just lovely. It has a bright yellow table with chairs and yellow brake front, and then a fireplace in it. And you've got ceramics, and you've got these straw ethnic figures on the mantle, and oil paintings. And it reminded me a little bit of Monet's dining room. But she loved to entertain, and she had you know, famous artists, Georgia O'Keeffe, of course, Leon Trotsky, André Breton, the famous French artist and art procurer, basically, who was responsible for her show in Paris. So it's just a comfortable ethnic but very classy feeling in the dining room. And then you go into the kitchen and it's light and airy and more yellow painted furniture. And she has Frida and Diego monogram their names and these little ceramics on the white whitewashed plaster wall, and you know, all kinds of different pottery. I mean, you just walk into that kitchen and you're in a good mood. The whole place makes you in a good mood, which that tells you that's so amazing, because this woman was she had so much sadness and pain. It's amazing how she created this happy place. So, you know, most people would just say, to hell with it. Really. Then you come to her studio. And this place, you could almost feel her presence in it. I mean, two of the walls. It, first of all, has very high ceilings. And most of the wall is all windows, and it's beautiful, kind of, it's not jealousy looking, but it's you can see outside, but they've got panes, and it's kind of like, well, it's iron. It's made out of iron, but it's painted white and everything. So you get a lot of natural light in there. Mm. And, you know, you see her table, her chair, all her paints, her brushes, her art supply. And there's a photo of Diego in there. Then on the other two walls, you've got all these bookshelves that are filled with books. And then her easel in her wheelchair. And you just go, my God. You know, here this woman, you know, painted, it did all this stuff, and she was in pain and in a wheelchair. And she did it. And you can really feel it in that room. And it's quite, like I said, it's very hallowed to be in there. Outside the courtyard is, I mean, maybe not as fantastic as the inside, but almost, because it's large. It's all walled in. It's this electric blue, and it has the, you know, they have all these different bay areas in some of the wall where they have pre-Columbian sculpture. Diego and Frida, especially Diego, collected all this pre-Columbian sculpture. So this is a sculpture garden of their collection, all through these luscious fountains and trees and shrub. They even have a pyramid in there that doesn't have a totally pointed top, but it's Diego's pyramid. She had it built, and they have sculpture on that. There's a kind of open air indoor room where I'm sure they entertained. It's very interesting. They have in this kind of lava, because I remember it's kind of lava stone. This room was connected. They have these fake windows on one side that's got gold mirrored glass. I mean, this place is so classy. I mean, I can tell you, it is artistic and bohemian, but very classy and comfortable and warm. So, yeah, and then also in this courtyard is, they talk about in this house, and one of the things that's so great, there's lots of commentary. So when you go there, they give you a lot of information. So it does really come more alive. But she loved monkeys, which was an Aztec symbol. She had parrots out there. And a Mexican hairless dog. That was her dog. And so this is where they would roam. So you can just see her out there in her gorgeous dresses with her paints, and, you know, probably having the fifth gin or whatever, gin and tonic, whatever. But look, she was living. And I think that's, I mean, I think that's pretty amazing and definitely super cool, you know? So the home itself is beautiful. Casa Azul was and is Frida. It's totally Frida. It's colorful, elegant, comfortable, exotic, interesting, just basically magical. And you feel it. Everybody feels it. There are a lot of people that travel to Mexico City just to go to this museum. And you'll see, when you go there, you'll see why. You know, I had a couple from California behind me that was doing exactly that. Also, they have a super gift shop there, and I bought the diary. In this trunk, they found a lot of her stuff, and one of the things they found was her diary. And there was a little fight about really opening it up or printing it, because it's way out there, you know, and she must have really been on a lot of painkillers and everything. But it is a real book about her psychological state. So I bought it and I read it, and it gave me more insight into her. Personally, and then they have a small cafe. So if you want to get something to eat, or I think they have ice cream there, and it's you can't really get a meal, but you can get something to eat, coffee, etc. I personally spent 3 hours there.
Wow.
And I really didn't want to leave. You know, I didn't really know very much about Frida before I visited there, but like I said earlier, I was completely blown away. I was blown away by her art, by her home, her love for Mexico and its people, her life, her persona, and her unbelievable soul. I mean, and you get it at the, you get it when you go to this museum. And that's very hard to do in a museum, because typically museums are just so factual and everything.
You get sterile, maybe.
Yeah, sterile. Exactly. But she was totally authentic, and there was no pretense in Frida. One of her favorite symbols was the butterfly. And she wore it in headdresses and jewelry. She painted them. And, you know, my mind, I don't know how it works sometimes, but I was looking at these portraits of Frida, and she had this monobrow. She's very famous for that. She was very beautiful, but she had these eyebrows that basically connected, and they looked like wings. And I thought to myself, you know, there's a stamp of the butterfly, the wings, right there on her face. There was no holding Frida down. She was going to fly, this woman. So I know that sounds really kind of convoluted, but even in her face, you know, most people would say, oh, you know, I've got a monobrow, it look horrible. Do I look like a man? Not her. Or cut. Not her. She wore it proudly, and she was beautiful with it. So the Casa Azul, oh la la, wonderful.
It's totally a must.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Well, so for our solo travelers, you're encouraging them, first of all, to go to Mexico City, but of course to make sure that they go to Casa Azul. Do you have any sort of quick tips for our solo travelers?
Yes. Yes. The biggest tip, and it's a must do, really, is you got to buy your ticket ahead of time, because the line sometimes supposedly can be as long as 4 hours long.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
And you had to compete with school kids.
Oh, yeah. No, but my ticket was for the 10 o'clock, the first, and they give you, when you buy your ticket, you get a certain time. And do not be late. If you're late, you miss your time and you lose your spot. So that is very important. Get either your concierge to get the ticket with the time, or you can actually do it online. But, you know, I would be a little bit afraid. I would get the concierge, which I did. Allow yourself, at least two hours. Even if you go through it quick, you'll want to linger in the courtyard. The gift shop is quite nice. You might want to get something to drink at the cafe, but there's a lot in there. So if you really want to absorb it all, minimum 2 hours. And then last, don't be like me. Do a little research before you go about her life and art. So you really will appreciate what you're seeing, because there is a lot in that house. I mean, Casa Azul is one of the most wonderful personal museums of somebody's home and life that I've ever seen anywhere in the world. So if you don't know anything about Frida, you know, do a little research, because going to Casa Azul will be a lot more memorable to you.
For listeners playing along at home, this podcast episode qualifies as some pre-trip research.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Okay. So I'll end kind of with Frida Kahlo embodied what is called Allegra, a lust for life. Someone once said, it's Kahlo's heroic battle in the face of feeling defective, deformed, and unloved that everybody taps into. Frida Kahlo is one of the most inspirational women of modern times. You really just can't get enough of her. And I must say, Frida Mania is alive and well, and I caught it. So I really think a visit to Casa Azul when in Mexico City is a must-do, in my opinion, even if you aren't an art lover or interested in art. To me, this is what solo travel is all about, being enriched by other cultures and other people's vibes. And a visit to Casa Azul is a fabulously enriching experience.
Listeners, as you prepare to go to Mexico City to visit Casa Azul, Astrid has something that's going to help your packing be just a little bit easier. She has an amazing packing list available for you. You can just go to her website, astridtravel.com, right there on the homepage. It's a place you can put in your email address and download the packing list right away. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify. We love people who subscribe to this show, because it not only helps you get this valuable information seamlessly, it actually will push the show out to other potential solo travelers so they can get this valuable information as well. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Hasta luego. Thanks, dear listeners. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Solo Travel Talk. Follow Astrid on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. To learn more about Astrid or her solo travel advisors, visit her website, astridtravel.com.